And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it's been an interesting day. We were out at the post exchange yesterday. And they were clearing out some top-of-the-line Sony TVs. We got one because our main TV, after a while, the screen will darken. Now, I've built computers and I've programmed computers, and I tell you, this thing is something else. And you can't get customer support, which I find fascinating. Well, today is September 23rd, 266th day of the year. Leap year's 267th day. Only 99 days remain until the end of this year. And it's frequently the day that of the autumnal equinox in the northern hemisphere and the vernal equinox in the southern hemisphere. And, you know, historically, it's been quite an interesting date in history. In 1122 A.D., Pope Calixtus II, the Holy Roman Emperor Henry V, agreed to the Concordat of Worms to put an end to the investiture controversy. Now, the European mainland experienced about 50 years of fights. With efforts by Lamberto Scannabici, the future Pope Honorius II, in the 121st Diet of Würzburg, to end the conflict. And it eliminated lay investiture while allowing secular leaders some room for unofficial but significant influence in the appointment process of those who were going to be bishops and abbots. The election, but this agreement allowed election of bishop and abbots in Germany to take place in the emperor's presence as the judge between potentially disputing parties, free of bribes, thus retaining to the emperor a crucial role in choosing who these magnates of the empire were going to be. But without a dispute, the canons of the cathedral to elect the bishop, monks were to choose the abbot, and beyond the borders of Germany and Burgundy and Italy, for example, the election would be handled by the church. In other words, this was an increase in the church's power. And as I've said, been more death and destruction in the name of religion than any other thing on the planet. 1338, the Battle of Imanuden, in which a French force defeats the English. First naval battle of the Hundred Years' War. And the first naval battle where gunpowder artillery was used. 1409, the Battle of Kurlin, is the second significant victory over the Ming Dynasty China by the Mongols since 1368. You know, if the Mongols had not had certain setbacks, they would actually have conquered the majority of Asia, one more time, Asia, and a good part of Europe. 1459, the Battle of Blore Heath, first major battle in English War of the Roses. The Yorks, or the Yorkist, as they were called, wins this one. 1641, the Merchant Royal, carrying a treasure of over 100,000 pounds of gold, is lost at sea off Land's End. Now, 100,000 pounds of gold in 1641 would be worth over £1 billion today, which is well in excess of $1 billion. 1642, the first commencement exercises occur at Harvard, and the world is a worse place for it. 1779, American Revolution, John Paul Jones, naval commander of the United States on board the USS Bahama Richard, wins the Battle of Flamborough Head. 1780, American Revolution, British Major John Andre is arrested as a spy by American soldiers, which exposes that Benedict Arnold has changed sides. 1803, Second Anglo-Maratha War. The Battle of La Salle is fought between the British East India Company and the Maratha Empire in India. Now, the British East India Company was a commercial venture, and it was able to fight wars and get support from the crown. 1806, Lewis and Clark returned to St. Louis after exploring the Pacific Northwest of the United States. Now, most folks think their expedition was simply, let's go see what's out there. It wasn't. You see, the Catholic Church decided what areas could be colonized and what areas couldn't. And if, in fact, there was a Christian contingent in any area, it could not be colonized. And it was decided, in regard to the New World, that the Native Americans were not Christian, even though they discovered a number of the tribes knew quite a lot about Catholicism. But it was decided to look and see if, in fact, there was a God, as they put it, God-fearing civilization somewhere in North America. Now, we know that there was a Roman colony outside of Phoenix, and there was rumors that there was a civilization, a rather advanced civilization, in the North Central, what became United States. So they actually went out looking to see if they could find any of these entities. They didn't. 1821, Tripolista in Greece is captured by the Greek rebels during the Greek War of Independence. 1845, the Knickerbockers Baseball Club, first baseball team to play under the modern rules, is founded in New York. 1846, astronomers Urbain Le Verrier, John Couch Adams, and Johann Gottfried Galle collaborated on the discovery of Neptune. 1868, Grito de Lares, or the Lares Revolt, in other words, occurs in Puerto Rico against Spanish rule. 1889, Nintendo Kapai, later Nintendo Company Limited, is founded by Fusahiro Yamauchi to produce and market the playing card game Hanafuda. 1899, the American Asiatic Squadron destroys a Filipino battery at the Battle of Olongapo. 1905, Norway and Sweden signed the Karlstad Treaty, peacefully dissolving the union between the two countries. 1911, pilot Earl Ovington makes the first official airmail delivery in America under the authority of the U.S. Post Office. Now, certainly there had been airmail deliveries prior to this, but this was the first official one. 1913, Roland Garros of France becomes the first to fly an airplane across the Mediterranean. He left St. Raphael in France and landed in Bizerte in Tunisia. 1932, the unification of Saudi Arabia is completed. 1938, the Czechoslovakian army is mobilized in response to the Munich Agreement. Now, the Munich Agreement, for those that are not familiar with it, was an agreement concluded at Munich on September 30th, 1938, by Nazi Germany, the UK, the French Third Republic, and the Kingdom of Italy, provided a cession to Germany of the Sudeten German territory of Czechoslovakia. Now, this was viewed as a way to prevent the war threatened by Hitler. It allowed Nazi Germany to annex the Sudetenland, which is inhabited by more than 3 million people, mainly German descendants. And this was supposed to be an agreement that allowed for peace in our time. Well, When a bully wins, he keeps going. 1942, World War II. Matanikau action in Guadalcanal begins. U.S. Marines attack Japanese units along the Matanikau River. 1943, World War II. The Nazi puppet state known as the Italian Socialist Republic is founded. 1950, Korean War. Battle of Hill 282. The first U.S. friendly fire incident on British military personnel since World War II. 1962, Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts opens in New York City. 1973, Argentine general election. Juan Perón returns to power in Argentina. 1983, St. Kitts and Nevis joins the United Nations. 1983, Gulf Air Flight 771 is destroyed by a bomb. Kills all 117 people on board. 1986, Houston Astros' Jim Desai sets a record, striking out the first eight batters he faces against the Los Angeles Dodgers. 2002, the first public version of the web browser Mozilla Firefox is released. It was called Phoenix 0.1. 2004, over 3,000 people die in Haiti after Hurricane Jean produces massive flooding and mudslides. 2008, Mahtisaari kills 10 people at a school in Finland before committing suicide. And 2019, the British travel company Thomas Cook Group declares bankruptcy, leaving employees without jobs and 600,000 customers stranded abroad. Hotels throughout the world are struck with over $450 million in unpaid bills. It was a major disaster. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays. Christian Feast Day. Adomnan. Sisa of Crowland, or of Northumbria. Blessed Emily Gamelin. Padre Pio. Pope Linus Sosius. Thecla in the Roman Catholic Church. Xantippe and Pollux Rena. Grito de Lares in Puerto Rico, Holocaust Memorial Day in Lithuania, Kazakh Language Day in Kazakhstan, National Day in Saudi Arabia, Teachers Day in Brunei, and in the bisexual community, they celebrate Bisexuality Day. All right, let's move on to see what else happened on this date in history. In 951, Otto the First becomes king of Italy. 1122, the Concordat of Worms, which we've already talked about. 1408, the Battle of Othi, the victory of John the Fearless, Duke of Burgundy over Liege. 1513, King Henry III and Emperor Maximilian conquer Tornik. 1561, King Philip II of Spain forbids Spanish settlements in Florida. 1739, Russia and Turkey sign the Peace of Belgrade. 1746, Jacob Giles appointed Dutch pension advisor. The John Paul Jones action, the Bahama Richard, defeated the British ship HMS Serapis. Up until that point in time, the defeat of a major British warship was unheard of. 1795, the Council of 500 forms in Paris. 1818, the border demarcation markers for Moresnet formally installed. 1830, the Dutch troops occupy Brussels. 1845, there's a hunger strike in The Hague. 1862, the Emancipation Proclamation is published in the Northern newspapers. 1862, Otto von Bismarck appointed Prime Minister and Foreign Minister of Prussia by King Wilhelm I. 1863, the Confederate siege of Chattanooga begins. 1879, Richard Rhodes invented a hearing aid. It was called the audiophone. I remember seeing one of those when I was very small. 1883, Mbunga, siege of Fort Mahinga, German East Africa, is broken. 1889, so many games played with silver and bronze coins, especially in Canada, that in 1907 there was a proclamation that set the fineness and weight of silver and bronze coins. A lot of people, coins, of course, erode over time. And people would get these coins from the bank and they'd shave off parts of it and melt it down and make new coins. 1908, University of Alberta opens. 1912, the first Max Sennett Keystone comedy is released. It was called Cohen Collects a Debt. 1913, Serbian troops march into Albania. 1920, Alexander Millerand becomes president of France. 1920, despite Japanese protests, China withdraws recognition of Tsarist representatives in China. 1926, there was a boxing match, and it was called the Upset of the Decade. Gene Tooney beats defending champion Jack Dempsey by a 10-round unanimous decision at Sesquicentennial Stadium for the heavyweight boxing title. 1932, Abdulaziz Ibn Saud merges the kingdom of Najd and Hajjaj into the kingdom of Saudi Arabia. You know, the royal family of Saudi Arabia struts and carries on, but until the British decided to organize the place, they were all shepherds. 1938, a time capsule to be opened in 6939. Was buried at the World's Fair in New York City. And in that time capsule is said to be a woman's hat, a man's pipe, and 1,100 feet of microfilm. What's on it has never been discussed. Let's see. 1940, the French and British assault the French fleet in the... 1940, Dutch Nazi collaborator Musset's first meeting with Adolf Hitler. Also in 1940, Dutch artist Piet Mondrian leaves Europe for New York, lives there the rest of his life. In 1941, General de Gaulle formed his government in exile in London. 1941, a German air raid on a Soviet naval base at Kronstadt. They sank a battleship. 1941, the first gas murder experiments are conducted at Auschwitz, German concentration camp. 1944, Proclamation 30 was issued, declaring the existence of a state of war between the Philippines, the U.S., and the U.K.
1949, Harry Truman announced evidence of Russia's first nuclear device detonation. 1950, and this was something I found with interest, Nobel Peace Prize awarded to Ralph Bunche for mediation in Israel. He was the first African-American winner of the Nobel Prize. 1952, Richard Nixon made his first Checkers speech. 1952, undefeated Rocky Marciano knocks out defending champion Jersey Joe Walcott in the 13th round at Municipal Stadium in Philadelphia. He won the world heavyweight boxing title. 1952. Let's see if there's anything else. I think that's pretty much got it. I'm going to go back to talking about creatures of the night. You know, there's a lot of what I would call shadows or shadowy areas where things have been seen that really defy explanation. For example, in 1916, explorer Erwin O'Malley told a story of his discovery of the fossilized remains of a massive animal. Now, that the creature was never formally identified, led to rumors of what O'Malley came upon were the remains of nothing less than an example of a legendary Chinese dragon. According to his story, during the latter part of a holiday trip to the Yangtze Gorge, undertaken by he and his wife in November 1915, they met Mr. Hewlett, British consul at Yichang, and his wife, and in their company, spent a day on the Yichang Gorge, landing at various points to climb the cliffs and explore some of the caves. And while they were exploring a large cave on the right of the bank of the river, and about a mile above the customs station at Pingshan Pa, they discovered the fossils that made such a caused such an uproar. The cave is reputed by the Chinese to extend about 20 miles to a point near Yichang. It's reported that a party from the HMS Snipe spent 3 days in the cave a number of years ago, and they failed to find the end. Evidence that the party penetrated beyond the point where the discoverers made exists in the name of their ship painted on the cave wall at a point considerably further in. The Chinese name of the cave is Xing Kan Zhu, which means the holy shrine, and one of the characters forming the word Kan is the Chinese character for dragon. Now, there's a large rock seen at the entrance, and about 8 or 10 yards behind that rock is a peculiar piece of curved rock bearing some slight resemblance to a portion of a dragon's body. Now, the resemblance is possibly suggestive enough to impressed the Chinese mind, but altogether fails to impress the foreigner. At least that was the opinion of Mr. Hewlett. After proceeding some hundreds of yards inside the cave, they found themselves walking on a particular ridge in order to avoid the surrounding pool of water. The ridge curved backward and forward across the width of the cave, like the curves of a large serpent. The suggestion being so strong, they lowered their lamps in order to examine the ridge more closely. To their astonishment, they found that they were actually walking on a perfectly preserved fossil of some huge reptile. Further inspection showed the presence of 6 or 8 of those enormous monsters. Having taken a few small specimens of the loose portion of scale for examination in better light, they left to return the following morning to carry out some measurements. On their return the following morning, they selected one of the largest fossils, lying for a greater part of its length isolated from the others. The corals of the others were somewhat entangled. The isolated portion measured 70 feet, so it was absolutely certain the length is at least 70 feet. And as far as they could tell, that same specimen extended for another 60 or 70 feet further in. Now, Mr. O'Malley did say that an error in measurement was possible owing to the interlacing coils of the reptiles. The depth of the body seemed to be about, in the foreground, seemed to be 2 feet. The head's partially buried in the cave wall and appears to be large, flat head, similar to that of a Mosasaurus comparii. About 12 or 14 feet from the head, two legs are seen partially uncovered. And again, to more than 50 feet from the head. The fact that several people have penetrated this cave in former years beyond this point where the discovery was made seemed to indicate the fossils have been but recently uncovered by a heavy discharge of water that flowed through the cave. It seems probable that the reptiles were trapped by some volcanic disturbance and starved to death. The size of the bodies compared to their length would seem to indicate this as true. Point of peculiar interest is the semblance, or the resemblance to the Chinese dragon of these fossils. Now, it had been earlier supposed that the Chinese borrowed their idea of the dragon from Western mythology. But the discovery of these fossils created a great stir among local Chinese and foreigners who were daily flocking to view the fossils. He said he was attempting to interest the Chinese authorities in Peking and in the Chinese Monument Society in order that the specimens might be preserved from damage. Now, it's been suggested that what O'Malley observed were the fossilized remains of a huge Chinese sauropod, which was named a Mammasaurus. On the other hand, O'Malley's reference to the remains having resemblance to the Chinese dragons given rise to the possibility that in the distant past there may have been fire-breathing dragons in China. Well, while there are numerous reports of people encountering massive snakes in the jungles of our world, certainly the strangest case on record is one that involves none other than the CIA. Now, I will say that I took all these stories of huge serpents with a grain of salt until the day in the jungle my APC ran over a snake that was so... We were on a jungle road that was about 8 feet wide. And there were 4 or 5 feet of snake on either side of the road in the bushes. Now, the Panamanians consider snake a delicacy. And they would have cut it up into snake burgers if I'd let them do it. We were en route to someplace, so... And now, an APC is a couple of tons. And it should have crushed your average snake. I don't care what kind of snake it was. But in this particular case, all it did was skin it and piss it off. Now let's get back to the CIA and their snake. Now the story is an intrigue-filled one. Part James Bond, part Indiana Jones. And it all began and rather violently ended in 1956. Now CIA personnel based out of the American Embassy in Bolivia were used to dealing with unpredictable, strange events. But even by their standards, what took place in August of 1956 was off the scale. In the early days of the month, the CIA staff got reports of a gigantic snake on the loose in a nearby, rarely explored cave that was deeply buried in the mountainous jungle environment. And when we say gigantic, we're talking about somewhere between 30 and 50 feet long. Now that would make the one that I encountered seem like a baby. Worse still, a number of mysterious disappearances of people from nearby tribe, just about everybody in the area on the edge, tribespeople were sure the culprit was the snake, and there were even rumors that the monster possessed supernatural powers. The time came when something had to be done, and a call was put into the CIA by the local Bolivian authorities asking for help. Now, hunting for a giant snake is hard to cut type of thing the CIA agents normally got involved in, but they said they would check it out. A six-person team put together by a man that was known only as Lee. Went deep into the jungle. And they were prepared to take on the man-eater, but as circumstances were demonstrated, it turned out to be a very close call. This supersized snake was not about to go down without a fight. And as Lee's team climbed a heavily wooded hill and arrived at a small entrance to the cave where the snake made its lair, everybody was as silent as possible and was prepared for a potentially deadly confrontation with this massive creature. Each and every man in the group had several tear gas canisters, and they all carried 45s. I mean, you know, frankly, we're talking about secret agents. They had something else with them as well. A large canvas sack with zippers at both ends had been created by CIA employees in which it was hoped the snake could be enticed into and then shot and killed before it could do any more harm. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm after a 30 to 50 foot snake, I'm not going to ask it to get in the bag. I'm going to shoot it. Nevertheless, each and every man strategically positioned himself at varying points around 20 feet from the cave entrance. Then Lee, the leader, had the job of creeping up to the opening. And his first action at the entrance was to encase the entrance with that large sack and, through a small space, hurl one of the tear gas canisters into the heart of the cave. Well, he did so and then retreated. Which it turned out, in hindsight, was a very wise move. In less than a minute, as the tear gas filled the cave, the snake came charging out of the entrance. And the rumors that they had heard about the size of this creature living in the cave were suddenly and chaotically confirmed to not be rumors. Even the agents in question were shocked by the sight of this coiling monstrosity. It was about 40 feet in length and had a body thicker than an oil drum. And its fang-filled head was about the size of a horse's head. And to their utter consternation, in seconds it tore its way out of the sack, ripped it to shreds as it did, and then began to move slowly toward them. One and all backed away another 30, 40 feet as this creature just laid there and stared at him, no doubt trying to decide which one to attack and eat first. Well, Lee quickly realized it was a case of now or never, and he fired a salvo of bullets into the snake head. By all accounts, it took many more than several bullets to bring the creature down. Of course, it has to be said, this entire story has something of an unlikely feeling to it. It sounds more like an urban myth or something that a friend told a friend. But there is good evidence to suggest the event occurred exactly as it was described. This story was told by a man named David Atlee Phillips, a significant figure in the CIA in the 50s. He had spent a great deal of time in Mexico, Cuba, and Chile. And he crossed paths with Lee at a cocktail party in La Paz, Bolivia in 1958. And as the pair swapped stories of their adventures, the matter of the giant snake came up. Phillips admitted to Lee he had heard it and was dubious about the whole thing. And Lee said, well, he'd show him the snake skin, which he had preserved in the embassy basement. Even when he saw the evidence, Phillips was still somewhat doubtful about the story. He suspected Lee had gotten that skin from a collector and had created a story of a violent confrontation with a monster to impress a girlfriend or even several. But it did turn out, in hindsight, that was not the case. Phillips apparently developed quite an obsession about the snake saga and brought it up some months later with one of Marwin Merville Bell, a man who had ties to both the CIA and the Agency for International Aid in Bolivia. Over drinks, Phillips tackled Bell on the matter of the snake, since Lee was a friend to both of them. And Phillips said as he discussed the story of how the snake was killed, to this day, according to Phillips, Lee claims he made a canvas sack with zippers at both ends. Well, for a moment, Bell was silent, musing about the question, and he said, "Well, Mr. Phillips, I certainly have heard about that. I was the tail zipper man." Now, this confirmation finally convinced Phillips that the story was real. As for what the snake may actually have been, there's a distinct possibility it may have been a surviving relic of a massive snake that lived in what's now Colombia. Of course, it lived millions of years ago. Its name was Titanoboa. It's a lineage that connects it to both the boa constrictor and the anaconda of today. It could grow to lengths of 50 feet or more and weighed in at about a ton or so. Certainly not a monster one would want to cross paths with. So did secret agents of the CIA back in the 1950s take out of circulation the very last of the Titanoboas? Well, there are many who say yes. Well, let's talk about the adventures of a man named Philip Henry Gulse, an English naturalist noted for his knowledge of marine biology. Well, as always, when someone has something to sell, they somehow find my number. According to numerous accounts, there existed in the Caribbean in the 19th century a curious, crested, snake-like monster. This creature instilled fear in all who encountered it. Now, this story came from what was considered by everybody to be an impeccable source, a Victorian naturalist by the name of Philip Henry Gulse. And he told how, during the course of his research, he uncovered details of the story. Now, he spent a lot of time roaming this area between 1845 and 1846. From a respected medical man, he said he got a most interesting story. According to what Gulse wrote, he had seen in 1829 a serpent about 4 feet in length, but of unusual thickness, dull ochre in color with the well-defined dark spots. Had on its head a sort of pyramidal helmet, somewhat lobed at the summit of a pale red hue. Now, the animal that he saw was dead, and decomposition already set in. And according to the man telling the story to Gulse, he said the natives of the area were well acquainted with it. It represented it as making a noise not unlike the crowing of a cock, and it was addicted to eating chickens, which they considered very foul. Gulse had a friend named Richard Hill, who'd also heard about this odd beast. He heard it from a Spanish acquaintance in Hispaniola. And those in the know said it dwelled in the eastern regions of the island in what's now the Dominican Republic. According to what Gulse said, Hill's Spanish informant had seen the serpent with mandibles like a bird with a cock's nest with scarlet robes or wattles. Kind of like a rooster, I guess. And he described its habits. Perhaps in common fame rather than personal observation as a frequenter of hen roost, into which it would thrust its head and deceive the young chickens by its imitating a rooster and its attempts to crow. Gulse got another report about this creature from a Jamaican man named Jasper Cargill. According to what Cargill said when visiting Skibu in St. George, an estate of his father's, and descending the mountain road, his attention was drawn to a snake of dark hue that erected itself from some fragments of limestone it lay about the road, about 4 feet long and unusually thick-bodied. And he said he was surprised as greatly increased on seeing how it was crested, and from the far side of its cheeks depended some red-colored flaps like gills or wattles. After gazing at him intently for some time with his head well erect, it drew itself in and disappeared among the fragments of rock. Rather notably, Cargill's son managed to shoot and kill just such a creature a few years later. According to ghosts, some youngsters of the town came running to tell him of a curious snake, unlike any snake they'd ever seen before, that young Cargill had shot, went out for a day's sport in the woodlands of a neighbor. They described it as a serpent in all respects, but with a very curious-shaped head with wattles on each side of its jaws. After taking it in hand and looking at it, they placed it in a hollow tree, intended to return for it when they were on their way home. But they had strolled from the place so far that it was inconvenient to retrace their steps. When they went back the following day, the snake thing was gone. It's presumed to have been taken by a hungry scavenger. But the story was far from over at this point. Goss also recorded the experience of a man named Ulick Ramsey, who had seen in the hand of a barrack master at the barracks of the Spanish town a curious snake that he also said he had shot among the rocks of a little line of eminences near the railway about 2 miles out. It's called Craigellachie. It was a serpent with a curious shaped head, projections on either side of it, which he likened to the fins of an eel. Today, the true identity of the crested snake that apparently had the ability to mimic the cries of a chicken is still an enigma. But what it says is there's a lot of things roaming around in the jungles that we still don't know anything about. Well, let's talk about a 40-foot snake. In 1868, a Frenchman named Rod made a truly extraordinary statement regarding a monstrous near dragon-like snake seen in the California countryside. He had seen it earlier that same year, he said, which was estimated to be have an overall length of about 40 feet. And despite the controversial nature of the story, it was supposed by his friend and colleague, F.C. Bylick, both of whom were cutting wood and burning charcoal when the immense creature loomed into view. Rawl broke off some of the from the wood cutting to pursue nothing more threatening than a hare. Said following the beast, which appeared to dwell in the woods, swamps, and fields of the area. He said he'd proceeded 25 yards maybe when he emerged in an open space. That open space didn't exceed 30 feet in diameter. And as he entered it, the hare dragged itself into the bush on the opposite side, so he hurried up to try to catch it. At almost the same instant, he was startled by a loud, shrill, prolonged hiss, a sound that closely resembled the escape of steam from a cylinder of a locomotive. He stopped as suddenly as if his progress had been arrested by a rifle bullet. And looking toward the upper end of that clearing, his eyes encountered an object the recollection of which even now makes him shiver with horror. He said, curled up not more than 20 feet from where he stood was an immense serpent, the most hideously frightful monster that ever confronted mortal man. It was a moment before his senses could comprehend the dreadful peril that threatened him. Well, as soon as he realized his situation, his first impulse was to get the hell out of there. Not a limb or muscle moved in obedience to the effort of my will. He says, I was as incapable of motion as if I'd been hewn in marble. I tried to call for help, but the effort at articulation died away in a gurgling sound. See, the serpent lay in three great coils, its head and some 10 feet of its body projecting above, swaying to and fro in a sinuous, wavy convulsion like the tentacles of an octopus in the swift current of an ebbing tide. The monster stared at him with his great, hateful, lidless eyes, ever and anon darting its head menacingly in his direction, thrusting out its forked tongue and emitting hisses so vehemently I felt its breath upon my cheek. arching its neck, the serpent would dilate its immense jaws till its head would measure at least 18 inches across, and then dart toward him. Distending its mouth and exhibiting its great fangs, it looked like the talons of a vulture. As I stood in momentary expectation of feeling the tusk and being crushed in the constricting fold of that scaly monster, my situation was appallingly beyond description. In fact, it was beyond the conception of the most vivid imagination, he said. The blood ran down his back cold as Greenland ice and congealed in his veins. Every pulse in his body seemed to stand still and his heart ceased to beat. Even respiration was slow and painful. There was a choking, suffocating sensation in his throat. His lips became dry and parched. There was a ringing in his ears. Dark spots floated in front of his eyes. He would have fainted but for the horrifying reflection that if he gave way to such weakness, his doom was inevitable. The cold, clammy perspiration oozed from every pore, and so intense was his agony of fear that he suffered the tortures of the dam augmented a thousandfold. All while my physical capacities were prostrated and paralyzed, every mental faculty seemed preternaturally sharpened. It appears as if the terrible tension of his nerve and bodily incapacity immeasurably increased his range of vision and rendered his perceptive facilities critically acute. He said, not the slightest movement of that creature escaped me, and every detail of its appearance, size, color, shape, position, is alas only too strongly photographed upon his recollection. As he said, the creature lay in three immense coils, the triple thickness of its body standing as high as his shoulders. The monster was fully 20 inches in diameter in the largest place. His head was comparatively large, his tremendous jaws that at times dilated to twice their natural size, had enormous hook fangs that fitted in between each other when the mouth was shut. The neck was slender and tapering. The belly of the creature was a dirty whitish color, deeply furred with transverse corrugations. With the exception of about 10 feet of the neck and contiguous parts that were nearly black, the body of the serpent was brown, beautifully mottled with orange-colored spots on the back. And how long he stood there and looked at this creature, he didn't really know. Maybe it was only moments. To him, it seemed like ages. At length, the creature began to slowly uncoil, but whether for the purpose of attacking him or retreating, he didn't know. You could have but faint conception of his joy and relief when he discovered it was actually retreating. Lowering its crest and giving vent to a venomous hiss, the monster slowly went crashing through the chaparral, its head being plainly visible above the jungle. And for a moment, he could scarcely realize he was no longer threatened by a death too horrible to contemplate. There was a tingling sensation throughout his body from the top of his head to the soles of his feet as the blood again started to circulate in his veins. He attempted to step forward, but he was so numbed in his limbs that he fell to the ground. Finally recovering, he staggered through the chaparral into the open country. As he came from the thicket, he saw his partner a short distance up the ridge and motioned for him to come to him. When he did so, he was greatly alarmed at his friend's haggard appearance and excitedly inquired the cause. In reply, he pointed to the serpent, now about almost 100 yards away, a sight that threw him into the utmost consternation. They watched the creature till it disappeared from view in the rocky recesses of a cliff that overhung the river. Now, they were not able to measure the length of the creature very exactly by its passing parallel between two trees, its head being even with one while its tail reached the other. But it was at least 40 feet in length. Well, there are unknown creatures on almost every continent. Let's talk about one I'm somewhat familiar with, the giant boa. Now, the Hagenbecks were a family of collectors of all manner of animals who supplied the world's zoos with a large variety of exotic animals for more than 100 years. Hardly surprising, therefore, that they came across a number of extraordinary tales, and for that matter, extraordinary animals as well. Indeed, one of the Hagenbach's explorers was the very first person to encounter a pygmy hippopotamus. That was on February 28, 1913. In addition, explorer Lorenz Hagenbach had a particular interest in snakes, but not your average snake. It was supersized snakes that fascinated him, to the point where he made it his business to collect just about as many reports as he could. One fascinating story came to Hagenbach from a pair of Roman Catholic priests, Father Victor Hines and Father Protasius Frickel. Father Hines' story was particularly notable because it revolved around the sighting of a truly colossal monster. Well, according to the statement that Hines gave Hagenbach, this happened during the Great Floods in 1922. On May 22nd, to be exact, at about 3 o'clock in, he was being taken home by canoe from the Amazon, from Obidos. Suddenly, he saw something surprising in midstream. He recognized a giant water snake at a distance of about 30 yards. To distinguish it from the Sucuriju, the natives who accompanied him named a reptile because of its enormous size, Sucuriju giganti, giant boa. Crawled up in two rings, the monster drifted quietly and gently downstream. As soon as they sighted it, the crew stopped paddling. Thunderstruck, they all stared at the frightful beast. Hines said the body was as thick as an oil drum and its first visible length was at 80 feet. When we were far enough away and his boatman dared to speak again, they said the monster would have crushed us like a box of matches if it hadn't previously consumed several large capybaras. Such was the extraordinary nature of the encounter. Father Hines was hooked on finding out all he could about this immense creature. He learned that yet another huge bull had been shot and killed the day before as it tried to devour a capybara. Now, the capybara is the world's largest rodent. It can reach the size of a dog. And it wasn't before Father Hines had a second sighting of a massive snake. He said his second encounter with a giant water snake took place October 29, 1929. To escape the great heat, he had decided to go downriver at about 7 p.m. in the direction of Alemquer. About midnight, they found themselves above the mouth of the Piaba when his crew, seized with sudden fear, began to row hard toward the shore. Hines sat up and said, What's going on? And they muttered, There's a big animal. The same moment, he heard the water move as if a steamboat had passed. Immediately, he noticed several meters above the surface of the water two bluish-green lights like the navigation lights on the bridge of a river boat and shouted, No, no, look, it's a steamer. Row to the side so it doesn't run over us. But it wasn't a steamer. Petrified, they all watched the monster approach. It avoided them and recrossed the river at less than a minute. Crossing would have taken them 10 to 15 minutes, isn't it? In the boat. On the safety of dry land, they took courage and shouted to attract the attention of the snake. This very moment, a human figure began to wave an oil lamp on the other shore, thinking no doubt that somebody was in danger. Almost at once, the snake came to the surface, and they were able to appreciate clearly the difference between the light of the lamp and the phosphorescent light of the monster's eyes. Later on his return, Hines said the inhabitants of the place assured us that above the mouth of the Piaba there dwelt a Sucuriju giganti. And finally, we have the account of Raimundo Zima, Portuguese merchant, who Father Hines had the opportunity to talk to. According to what Zima said, on the 6th of July, 1930, I was going up to Jamunda in company with his wife and boy, who looks after his motorboat. Night was falling when they saw a light on the riverbank. He thought it was the house he was looking for, so he steered toward the light and switched on his own searchlight. Then they noticed the light was charging at them at incredible speed. A huge wave lifted the front of their boat and almost turned it over. His wife screamed in terror. At the same moment, they made out the shape of a giant snake rising out of the water and performing a St. Vitus dance around the boat. After which the monster crossed the tributary of the Amazon, about half a kilometer wide, at fabulous speed, leaving a huge wake larger than many of the steamboats make at full speed. As the waves hit their 13-meter boat with such force that at every moment they were in danger of capsizing, he opened his motor flat out and made for dry land. Owing to the understandable excitement at the time, it wasn't possible for him to reckon the monster's length. And he presumed that the result of a wound, the animal lost one eye since he only saw one light. And he thought perhaps the giant snake had mistaken the searchlight for the eye of one of his fellow snakes. But whatever may have been going on, certainly was to be sure a lucky escape. You know, reports of lake monsters abound across this planet. Among the most famous ones are Scotland's Loch Ness Monster, Ogopogo of Lake Okanagan, Champ of Lake Champlain. The big question is, if the creatures are real, then what exactly are they? Monster hunters suggest they may be relic populations of plesiosaurs, marine reptiles that are believed to have become extinct tens of millions of years ago. The theorists suggest the creatures might be immense eels. And then there's the giant salamander scenario. Now, salamanders are amphibians that are noted for their long tails, blunt heads, short limbs, and which, as in the case of the Chinese giant salamander, can reach lengths of 6 feet. But is it possible that some salamanders can grow much larger? Maybe even hit 15 or 25 feet? You may think that's incredible, but is it implausible? Steve Planbeck is a note of authority on a giant salamander theory when it comes to the matter of the Loch Ness Monster. According to what he says, Nessie is a bottom-dwelling, water-breathing animal that spends very little time on the surface or in midwater, although just enough to be spotted visually or by sonar on very rare occasions. Its forays up from the depths are most likely made along the sides of the loch to feed on the fish that are predominantly found along the sides in shallow water above the underwater cliffs that precipitously drop off into the 750-foot abyss. Such behavior is only consistent with a fish or aquatic amphibian, which can extract all its needed oxygen directly from the water. As seldom as it happens, and for reasons unknown to the animal itself, Nessie also leaves the water for short stretches, as observed most famously in the Spicer and Grant sightings of 1933 and 1934. It may be said that this is nothing new. It's a centuries-old tradition among the Highlanders that the Kelpie, or water horse of Loch Ness, does come ashore. That's a key behavioral trait to take into account if we're distinguishing fish from amphibians. In that sense, Planbeck makes a persuasive argument when it comes to the matter of the creatures of Loch Ness, possibly being huge salamanders, at the very least, another kind of large unknown amphibian. It's a theory also noted by a researcher by the name of Erica. According to her, and this might seem ridiculous at first, but in China, there's a species of giant salamander that can grow up to 6 feet long. And certainly this is an animal which is long enough, odd enough, if it surfaced in a lake, onlookers could be forgiven for mistaking it for a monster. There are other similarities that make this a plausible theory. The Chinese giant salamander lives in very cold fresh water, which describes Loch Ness handily. They're found in the rocky streams and mountain lakes of remote northern China, where they're as elusive as they are endangered. And best of all, the Chinese giant salamander is a pretty sluggish animal. It rarely surfaces and spends most of its time lying at the bottom waiting for prey to swim past. It strikes quickly and then retreats. It's not an active animal, and it's entirely possible they could live in a lake as big as Loch Ness without ever being seen at the surface. Then there's Loch Ness Monster Authority Roland Watson, who's gotten into this controversy. He said before long-necked stories began to dominate people's thinking, some held to the view that Nessie was some form of outsized amphibian, in particular the salamander. He said, "I'm a bit partial to a fish-like amphibian or amphibian-like fish theory myself, so we're in agreement to some degree. An amphibian has its issues just like any other Nessie theory, but I'm sure it can hold its own in the Nessie pantheon." He also commented on the theories of Steve Planbeck. One major block to a salamander interpretation of the traditional long neck of the creature. Salamanders do not have long necks. But perhaps the long tail of the salamander can account for this. And on that note, we're going to go, because we've run out of time. We'll be back tomorrow night. When once again, this will be Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great evening.